Okay. So I wanted to briefly tell you about exactly what we're doing, just so you'd get a better idea. Mm-hmm. As you know, Coolis was the BRAC team went up and decided to close Coolis and move them to Elmendorf.
Right.
And so prior to the, as soon as they made the decision, some crews from our company went up and did an architectural and an archaeological survey of the base.
Oh, okay.
And so what they found was that they decided that one of the buildings, Building 3, which is the hangar.
Mm-hmm. The little hangar.
Yeah, the small one and then the big one next to it.
Right.
They decided that that was eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places.
Okay.
So because they're going to tear down all the buildings on base, they had to figure out how they were, what the mitigation was going to be for destroying this building that is eligible for the National Register.
Mm-hmm.
So what they decided was that we would do a public, like a booklet. So this is for public consumption. So some military people, but it'll also be available to, you know, anyone who wants to read about it.
Sure.
So the nature of the booklet is not, not military tech. So, I don't want to say it's dumbed down, but it's definitely something that everybody should be able to read. So,
sure, okay.
And then, so we also, I don't know if you, I know, I, did you get the book? I think I sent it to you.
Well, I got the,
email?
Booklet text.
Okay, yeah, so we didn't send out the design because we're waiting to finalize the text.
Oh, okay.
But then when we get it completed, we'll definitely, we'll send you a copy for yourself.
Okay, thank you.
In the book text, we talk about the hangar and the architectural history of the hangar itself too.
Mm-hmm.
So and then in addition, we're interviewing some people and we're sending those to the University of Alaska Oral History Program.
Okay.
And so that's what we're doing.
They're a consultant with you, sort of.
Yeah, so we work, the National Guard Bureau is like the head agency, and we're working with Coolis, and we're just like, yeah, we're like a consultant for them.
No, I meant the University of Alaska is a consultant with you all.
Oh, actually, they're not involved that much. We just agreed that if we did interviews, that we would make sure that we sent them a transcript of the interview and then the sound recordings for their archives.
I see, okay.
Yeah. All right, so I think, unless you have any questions right off the bat, we can go ahead and get started.
That's fine. Go ahead.
All right, so you were the commander at the base. You started in 1958, correct?
Yes.
And you started as a...
As a duty or a drill pilot, they called us then.
A drill pilot?
A drill pilot.
Oh, okay. What does the drill pilot do?
Well, you you have a certain number of drills that you're required to... complete throughout the year. And we as pilots were authorized an extra 24 of them, I think it was, throughout the year. And so you were, when you went out and flew, you were a drill pilot.
Oh, I see. And so had you been in the Air Force prior to that, where you actually learned to fly jets and stuff?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Where were you, when did you join the Air Force?
In 1953.
And were you in Alaska then, or were you...
Oh, no, I went through training, and then I, as an instructor, I was sent to Germany to help retrain the Luftwaffe.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, you were you from Alaska? Is that why you came back?
No, I was born and raised in the Northwest.
Oh, okay.
Excuse me.
I see.
Yeah, I flew with the reserve in Portland, Oregon, just before coming to Alaska.
Oh, okay. And then you joined as the drill pilot in 58.
Right.
And then, so what rank were you when you entered the Alaska Air National Guard?
First lieutenant.
First lieutenant, okay.
Because
I thought it was crazy if you joined in 58. And then when were you, you became commander in 1964?
Yes, that's right.
And then what rank were you at that point?
Major.
Major. All right. And then how you were in there until 70? Well, you were commander until 70, 71?
71, yeah.
And then did you retire at that point, or?
No, I retired in about 91.
What happened after you left command at Coolis? Were you still there, or?
Well, I was down in the state headquarters.
Oh, okay. What were you doing at the state headquarters?
Operations staff officer.
I see. So when you retired in 1991, what was your rank when you left?
Lieutenant colonel.
Lieutenant colonel. All right. So, can you tell me about how the base looked in 1958 when you first got there?
It was pretty small. It was probably about 30 acres.
Yeah.
And they had both the little hangar, as you call it, and the expanded one.
Yeah.
Were there. They had a base supply building, a POL structure, and a motor pool and a fire station.
Wow. Not very big.
No, was not.
And so when you started flying in 58, were you flying the C-123Js?
No, they didn't get those until 60.
Oh, until 60, okay.
I flew the C-47.
Oh, that's right.
Yep.
Okay. What kind of, missions, I guess, were you doing when you first showed up?
Well, a lot of training, but also we supplied some of the remote radar sites.
Yeah, so you started with the C-47s with that, right? And then when you guys got the C-123s, I think Elmendorf didn't have them anymore, right? And so you were the only group that was flying them?
No, Elmendorf had the B models.
Oh, okay.
And
so you were the only ones flying the C-123Js?
Yeah.
Okay. Supplying the dew line stations?
Well, it was fairly routine, except the electronic approaches were pretty primitive.
Yeah.
And then the weather complicated that situation to some degree. The only ones with really good electronic approaches were Anchorage and Fairbanks.
Oh, okay.
About that time.
And how often would you guys go up there and do that?
It varied a little bit, but usually at least two or three missions a week.
Oh, really? All right. Let me see. So when you guys got the C-123Js, was there any changes to any kind of mission that you guys did, or was it still the same kind of stuff you were doing?
The same sort of stuff, except the capabilities would grossly increased. The 123, or excuse me, the C-47, we were limited to about a 3,000-pound load.
Oh.
And when we got the 123s, it went up to a 10,000-pound load.
Wow. What kind of stuff were you taking up there? I mean, clearly.
Oh, whatever you can imagine. diesel fuel, groceries, supplies for the radar maintenance, and the whole gamut.
Where would you guys get that stuff from? From Elmendorf?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We were hauling from Elmendorf for them, and so with whatever they had and needed.
What other kinds of missions did you guys have in general? I know you guys did a lot of state work in the early 60s and stuff.
Right. We supported, I think it's in the text here, glaciological research on the Taku Glacier right above Juneau. That was ski work. And then when the state needed us for some things, as an example, the highway going south from Anchorage towards Seward was very susceptible to avalanches.
Yeah.
And occasionally we would haul 75-millimeter recoilless rifle rounds from Juneau into Anchorage so that the State Highway Department could utilize those to trigger avalanches.
I see.
When they wanted it done rather than when Mother Nature would have it happen.
Yeah, definitely. So tell me about the skis. Do you remember, I guess when you guys got the C-123Js, did they come with skis at the same time, or was there a period where you weren't using the skis?
No, those 10 airplanes were built for SAC, Strategic Air Command, so they could supply and operate from the ice island T3. And when they decided no longer to support and operate T3, I think they did those out of, can't remember the Air Force base in New York, upstate.
Stratton?
No. At any rate, that's where SAC operated them, and it wasn't very long. until they decided not to operate T-3 anymore. So those airplanes became surplus.
I see.
When we got them, there was very low time. Most of them had around 200 hours or less.
Oh, wow.
And we got 10 of them. And then we lost two in accidents down the road. But we got all 10. The Air Force operated them for, like I said, a short time. And then we got them. To us, they were almost brand new.
Wow. So can you tell me, I don't know what T3 is.
It's an ice island where they used to do weather research for Strategic Air Command.
I see, I see. So you said you had 10 and then you lost two. How did you lose those two?
Well, one of them crashed on an approach to Cape Romanzoff, one of the mine stations. And then one went in the bay at Valdez following or during the earthquake period.
Oh, okay.
Shortly after it.
I see. So the skis, were they, did you have C-123Js that didn't have skis, or was it just the 10 that you got?
Well, the 10 that originally when were built with skis, we got all of those, but we had 7 of those de-skied, as we say, and the skis taken off.
I see.
That was a modification done at the factory.
Oh, so they're not just like things you can pop on. It's actually like...
Oh, no.
Okay.
No, it was an integral part of the airplane.
Oh, wow. So was it different to... Because I've seen them where when you're taxiing out, the skis kind of lift up. Is that like a mechanical thing, or do you know what
yeah.
I mean?
You mean when they're operated on wheels and taxiing?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You could select either skis or wheels.
I see.
From the cockpit.
Now, was it weird or different since you've flown both? Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Was it... I guess that's a good question. Did all the pilots fly the ones with skis and the ones without?
No. Since we had 70% of them without skis, and the skis were only needed for some pretty specific missions, we had probably a third of the crews qualified in on skis.
I see.
And, you know, the airplane operated very much the same, except that you needed a longer run to get off from skis because of the adhesion of the snow.
I see. I was going to ask about that, how it was different landing and taking off.
Well, it's like anything. There's slight differences, but...
Yeah. I would think it'd feel, when you're landing on skis, that would there be more sliding around, or I guess with all that weight, yeah?
Except that, you know, it's a heavy airplane, so
yeah.
It's going to sink into the snow.
Yeah, definitely. What kind of missions did you use the skis for? I know one was the glacier.
Mm-hmm. And occasionally we would operate on the rivers. You talk about Operation Santa Claus.
Oh, okay.
We landed on the... a slough of the Yukon River to deliver stuff there, and we did that for a lot of years.
And how did you guys, I mean, this is silly, I don't live in Alaska, how did you know it would be solid? Did you have to test, or
well,
was it just you know?
Well, we would ask some local folks.
To go out there and make sure?
And people that live there would recall how the freeze took place. Sometimes it'd freeze a little bit and snow a lot, and that's not very healthy because it gets pretty punky snow.
Yeah.
I mean, punky ice. But if it froze hard before the snow, then they knew it was fairly deep.
I see.
Fairly thick ice.
So were there any changes that need to be made when you guys got the skis you guys got the C-123Js with the skis. Were there changes to the base that need to be made? Like, do you know what I mean?
Well, the addition to Hangar 3, as you guys are terming it, we couldn't use it originally because the tail was too tall for the truss superstructure.
I see, between the C-47s and the C.
Right.
I see.
The hangar would accommodate a couple of C-47s without any problem. When we got the 123s, the tail was so tall, and we developed a nose jack system, which lifted the nose and dropped the tail, so we could back it in and then let the tail come up between the trusses.
Oh, wow.
In the hangar, so we, otherwise we couldn't have utilized the hangar at all.
Wow. And so, and then eventually did they changed it so that you could...
Right. They expanded it, actually they sort of cut a channel down the middle.
Yeah.
And then reinforced it.
So how did, who in this nose jack, is that what you called it?
Mm-hmm.
Was that, is that something you guys invented, or is that something that exists for...
No, it was developed in our machine shop.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
It was. It was. It saved a lot of anguish and trouble, and we could use the hangar before they could go through the laborious process of finding money to modify it.
Yeah, definitely. Money's always the key. How long did you guys have to use that for?
Oh, boy. Seems to me we did that 5 years or better.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, smart guys up there.
Yeah, we had a dang good machine shop.
Yeah. Well, I know that General Bellier, when he was talking about it, he was saying that the crew that was up there was just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the good features about the Guard generally, and the Air Guard particularly, is that they have tenure and continuity with their maintenance force. And this is opposed to the active service that rotate people every 3 or 4 years.
Oh.
And we had folks that had been there 16, 18, 20 years. And so they just get better at their job.
Yeah. Actually, Bellier said that someone at Elmendorf was like, your crew, like the maintenance guys have been there, like they've been in working as long as the Elmendorf, like, pilots have been alive. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, that's true.
Yeah. So when you started flying, have you always flown transport at when you got to the...
No, during the active, I flew fighters.
Okay.
That's where I trained.
Yeah.
And then I went to multi-engine when I got to the reserve in Portland.
Which do you prefer, flying big planes or flying fighters?
Well, they're both fun, but I do like having a crew available.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I can understand that. Okay, so... Can you tell me about, have you read the text of the
document? Yes, I have.
Oh, okay. How did you feel about it?
Oh, I think you did a good job.
Okay.
There's some things I would straighten out.
Oh, yeah. Well, definitely. That's why I'm glad you're reading it. And are you going to, you think you'll be able to, do you want to tell me those or do you want to fill out the sheet? Would that be better?
Well, why don't I tell you, and then if you think I need to expand it, in writing, I can sure do that.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I appreciate that you're coming at it from a journalist standpoint.
Yeah.
And so, as long as you're not violating technical details and that sort of thing, fine and dandy. But you want to just, shall I just go, there's maybe a half a dozen of these is all.
Why don't we...
You want to go by the pages, or...?
Let me do that at the end, because I don't have the text with me, but I can get that pulled up.
Oh, okay.
So I was just going to ask, because... in there we talk about the ferrying of the 123Ks, I think, from the Philippines.
Right.
You were... That was in 67, and so were you commander then?
Yes.
So can you tell me exactly what that was about? Were they planes from Maryland and you were just ferrying them because you had extra pilots, or how did that work?
Well, Vietnam was going on.
Yeah.
Maybe you remember.
I heard about that.
But what they did is they modified the B models with jet engines slung on the wing between the drop tanks and the main engines. And this gave them increased short field performance. And, excuse me, I got another...
Oh, you're fine.
How you doing, Greg? I'm on a long distance. Can I call you when I'm done? Okay. Greg. You want to call Greg, see what it was? Okay, I'm back.
Okay.
And so they they were using 123s heavily in Vietnam, of course.
Yeah.
And they needed this additional short field performance and weight capability. And so they modified them at the Hagerstown plant, which was Fairchild Airplane Company.
So this is...
And a lot of the 123 qualified pilots were already operating in Vietnam. So there was a shortage of crews to ferry those that were done with the modification. And I don't know how fast they put them through the mod. I don't recall all those details. But so they sparred about and said to anybody that is qualified, we'd like to talk to them or have them come on board for a mission or multiple missions and so forth.
I see.
And one of the first ones to get ferried was done by one of our 144th crews. And so they asked specifically if they could come through Alaska and then go on over. And then they gave us a demonstration of, you know, because we had wingtip jets on the J's.
Yeah.
But they didn't give the performance that these new ones were three times the thrust.
I see. So they took C-123Bs, the plane manufacturing company did, and modified them and made them the Ks.
That's right.
I see. And then you guys ferried them. How many did you guys move back and forth? Do you know?
Well, in most cases, they didn't. They didn't fly them back. Didn't fly a B model back.
Oh, okay.
And I can't remember whether they hauled them, on a carrier or just what, but. There was some of that, but of course they all had to be flown back, or they chose to do it that way. Actually, there were not too many that came through Alaska. Once they got the routine going, they flew them through California, to Hawaii, to Wake, and so forth, into Clark Field. Our crew still did a lot of the flying, but they didn't have that many come through Alaska.
It was
it's not going to change your story very much because we did Alaskanize them, and that was the same guy that developed the nose jack.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that Connie Miller was his name.
Oh, okay.
And at any rate, I don't know if I've answered your question about the Ks.
No, that helps. I think that, you know, we heard the story initially, but then we didn't really understand what was happening or why they were ferrying them since they were from Alaska.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful. So you took command in 1964.
Right.
And then in March of 64 was the Good Friday earthquake. Were you in command at the time or had you not?
No, I was not.
Oh, okay. When did you take command in 1964?
Oh, probably was September, in the fall. It was probably either April or May of 64 when we lost the Adjutant General. That was one of the 123s lost at Valdez.
Okay.
And they just dropped the governor off for an inspection tour of the damage done to the town of Valdez, since he grew up there, partly.
I see.
Anyhow, and they had an interim Adjutant General in Juneau, and then they permanentized it in the fall, and my boss became the Adjutant General, and I took his position as squadron commander.
Who was the commander right before you?
I think it was Dean Stringer.
Okay. But you were around during the earthquake. Do you have...
Oh, yeah.
Do you have some personal memories of it?
Yeah. We supported Kodiak, Seward, and Valdez for about 2 weeks by air since they'd had damage to superstructure, roads, harbor, and so forth.
Yeah.
And one time I went into Seward with a load of supplies and this and that and was about to leave, and a pickup comes screaming out the road, blinking these lights and honking the horn and so forth, and said, "We've got a gentleman in town who was washed out of his cabin by the tsunami, and broke both ankles. He crawled into town, some like a mile, and he needs to get to a hospital. So I said, well, shoot, we can wait. And then another guy came out and said, we've heard a report that there's another tsunami in the bay, and I'm going to get in my airplane and fly down there, maybe 4 or 5 miles, and if I come back rocking my wings, well, I get out of here because a wave is coming.
Yeah.
And I said, you know how fast that wave will travel underneath the water? And the bay is pretty deep.
Yeah.
And he said, no. And I said, well, up to 500 miles an hour. And he said, well, what's that got to do with it? And I said, you're flying at about 90 miles an hour, and it's going to take you 3 minutes to turn around. And that time, that wave is already here.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, well, I'm going down there anyway. And I said, okay, have fun. And we took the injured guy back to Anchorage, and I just was humored by this guy saying, well, I'm going to fly down there in my little cub, and I'll come back and warn you.
And it was nice that he was trying to help out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But there wasn't any wave.
Yeah. Oh, well, good. Well, and it seems like it was devastating enough.
Yeah.
Harold, I wanted to let you know that my boss, Marge Nowick, just stepped into the office. Do you mind?
No, I don't mind. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how you doing?
Oh, it's Marge. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was Mark.
So, can you tell us, was Kula's damaged during the earthquake? I mean, were you, I guess, I don't know what time it happened exactly.
Oh, you mean daytime?
Yeah, what time?
It was about 5:30 in the afternoon.
Were you at the base at the time?
No, matter of fact, I was en route back from the Pentagon, where we'd been trying to convince them we were better than they thought we were, or whatever.
What were you, did they want to get rid of you guys, or were you guys looking for more money?
As a matter of fact, they did have us on the Y-out schedule.
Oh, wow.
But at any rate, and I got back the next day, or that night, really.
Oh, okay. What was the...
Friday. I got back Saturday night.
Okay, so...
And it was pretty dark around here.
Oh, yeah, I bet. Was the base damaged?
Yeah, a little bit. Not as bad as it could have been. It damaged the hangar door, and we couldn't open it mechanically. Had to do it by pulling on a chain physically.
Oh, wow.
And excuse me. And then we just had a brand new steel structure for our base supply building, and it twisted out a little bit. We had, I suppose, in 64 terms, $250,000 worth of damage.
Oh, okay.
It could have been a lot worse.
And so, was the runway that you guys were using?
Had some heaves in it, yeah.
And did that pose a problem for you guys when you were flying?
Well, they closed it until it could be inspected, because if it had thrown an airplane in the air, you know, with people in it, it could have been pretty bad.
Yeah.
They diverted most all the traffic into Elmendorf. Matter of fact, that's where I landed when coming back on Northwest Saturday after the quake.
Wow.
And so, that was scary. I walked into their operations area, and it was all artificial light. And here's a 16 by 16 concrete beam laying down over a desk that had been flattened.
Whoa.
And I had not heard from my wife. Matter of fact, the Friday afternoon, I was calling her to let her know where things were, and the phone went dead. The operator said, I've never had the phone go dead like that before. I'll keep calling and find out and let you know. And of course, I never heard because the lines were out.
Yeah.
Yep.
Was everything all right?
Oh, yeah. Fortunately.
Yeah, good.
We had a crack in the sidewalk or two, but other than that, it wasn't bad.
Yeah, it's from some of the pictures, it sounds like that was a...
Oh, boy. Our base photographer shot 100 slides and made a copy of them, and I still have those.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Of what kind of shots was he taking?
Oh, all of the... You've seen the one where there's a car perched on a little peak.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sort of shot around town, where the Third Avenue sunk about one story width.
Yeah. It seems like the downtown area and everything north was really...
That's where the fault line kind of snaked through.
Yeah. So what kind of stuff did you guys do in to support during the earthquake? What kind of sorties were you guys flying, and what kind of missions were you doing?
Well, mainly, like I said, for about 2 weeks, we supported Kodiak, Seward, and Valdez, all sorts of things. Supplies for the dispensary, let's say, food, some construction materials for straightening things out, correcting them temporarily, and so forth.
And was Elmendorf and other units in different states, were they helping, or was it just...
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. You betcha. Yeah.
It was a group effort. Everyone was helping out.
Yeah, the governor met with the commanders from Elmendorf, Fort Rich, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly in Fairbanks area.
So I've heard that the airport control tower, the actual, not your guys' tower, but the airport's tower, that it collapsed?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah. Well, it was, we shared the runway and the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And they used one of our 123s for a short while. Excuse me. Matter of fact, I had a personal friend that came down with that tower.
Oh.
He survived with just a couple...
Wow. Steps. So, and I'd heard that someone had died in the tower.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
This guy's partner working that night.
Jeez. So, the C-123s, did they provide radio control for that?
Well, yes, they did. I don't remember how long, but... probably until they got the word out that the base or the runway was closed.
I see. So just until they could tell people to stop landing. Was there a moment in that time that you really remember that really, you know?
Oh, other than that one I was telling you about at Seward, but you're talking about the actual moment of the quake?
Oh, I'm thinking more just, you know, something that during that period of time where you guys were helping out, if there's something that you were really struck by.
Well, the fact that people could find some shelter. We had about 100 folks in the base supply building that had cots and survived, and we opened up the mess hall and fed them and so forth.
We've seen a photo of that, and at one point we were told it was the hangar, but the roof didn't look right, but it was the base supply building.
Right, yeah.
I see. And then did you guys have, besides flying missions, did you guys have guardsmen in the community out doing stuff?
Well, the Army Guard did most of that, although we did some of the, and then, like I said, our base photographer took photos all over the place.
Yeah.
And... But we were mainly doing the fly-in missions to the three communities and others, but those three really needed it.
Yeah. How much, well, you said people were housed at the base or stayed at the base. Was that just an overnight kind of immediate emergency response, or were there people there for a while?
Well, I think we might have had a few hangers on for a week, but primarily it was just a night or two.
I see.
Where would they have gone from after if they had stayed at the base for the first few nights, where would they have gone afterwards?
At relatives, or if their home was okay and they could get back into it, that sort of situation.
Yeah, they'd go back home.
So, and then you were also commander in 1967 during the Fairbanks flood.
That's right.
You had some rough times there.
Yeah, that was an exercise. The FAA had abandoned the tower and the ops building, and so we just sort of took it over, used some of their vehicles and the whole nine yards. And as a result, when the FAA left, there was no longer a tower in operation, so we we sort of filled in there, particularly for the our own relief flights, and we had some come from even outside Idaho. The Air Guard in Idaho came up with a C-54 load of stuff.
Do you feel like your experience during the earthquake, that it helped you, you know, organize and prepare for the flood relief?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would certainly say so. We had just gotten a new accounting machine in 67, and so we were able to, without having to use pencil and eraser, you know, catalog all people who called from Anchorage area saying, I can accommodate a couple or a family or one or whatever, and marry that up with those some 3,300 that we brought in from Fairbanks.
So that was the difference between the earthquake and Fairbanks. It wasn't just ferrying supplies, it was also bringing people, like getting them out of the water and the, right?
Yep, that's right.
Was there more, were you guys doing supplies and stuff and gear for Fairbanks, or was it just ferrying people?
What was the first part of your question?
Oh, I was asking if you guys did fly missions where you were dropping gear and supplies for people.
Oh, yeah. We took pumps and, plastic and, I'd be hard put to remember all of the variety of stuff we took up there, but the Corps of Engineers and some other federal agencies were coordinating what needed to be done, and so they dictated the materials and supplies in that vein to accomplish their thing. And the Air Force had some heavy lift stuff going on, but we were able to respond probably a little quicker since we had the kind of airplanes in country that could really do a helping job.
Yeah. Wow. So 3,300 people you guys brought back?
That's what I remember. Somewhere close to 3,300.
And then once they got to the base, what happened when they finally got off the plane? Did you guys have guardsmen who were helping send them, or was there someone who was coordinating that on the ground?
Well, our administrative folks were coordinating the folks in Anchorage who said, I can accommodate some folks.
Mm-hmm.
And then we opened the mess hall again, and they could have coffee and some snack goodies and so forth while they awaited. But very seldom did they wait more than an hour, let's say, for somebody to say, I'm coming to get you. What do you need besides what you got on your back and so forth?
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was the whole community really helped out?
Absolutely.
That's good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Good. That's typical of Alaska.
Everyone was very great when we were there. So you were the commander almost during the height of the Cold War, when it was pretty, I don't know, everyone was really kind of nervous about it, at least everyone in the lower 48 was. Did you feel that kind of pressure?
Oh, yeah. We started a project to build a base-style size shelter that we felt would survive, and then decided that maybe it wouldn't survive anyway, so we did our best to keep Coolis operating so that if Elmendorf were hit, then there'd be a little bit of survivability 7 miles away.
Yeah. This base-style building, is it like, do you mean like a, almost like a bunker?
Yeah, yep.
Wow.
Exactly. Dug into the hill and protect it out front as best possible.
Where were you guys going to build it at?
Just west of the big hangar you've been talking about.
Oh, okay. But then that was scrapped.
Yeah.
Hmm. That would have been interesting, though.
Well, we'd have to build it out of pocket.
Oh.
You know, so.
That's a big...
To do it right with all the communications and life support stuff, it got to be a bigger project than we could handle.
Were there other precautions that you guys were taking during that period? That maybe were different or were more than...
Well, we put people through the survival training for radioactivity and that kind of stuff.
I see.
And that was going on everywhere.
Yeah. Was there, did you guys have missions where you interacted with the Soviets?
Not while I was commander.
No.
They did a few years down the road, and some of those were quite successful.
Yeah, I knew that there were some, well, you've read the text, so you know we talk about the gray whales, but there was also the, there was a, what was the joint, I forgot it now, it's been so long since I've written it.
Yeah, well, they had, I think that's when Ken Taylor was commander, they had some interaction in a simulated airliner crash in the recovery that would be attempted, at least.
Oh, I see. What was I going to ask? I asked you about the Dewline stations. Do you feel like, is there missions while you were commander that kind of have gotten overlooked?
By overlooked, you mean that you guys haven't heard about?
Well, maybe things we haven't heard about, but something that you feel was a like an important part of your time as commander that maybe isn't as well known?
No, nothing comes to mind right offhand. The one that that you may want to look into is just before, well, possibly 63 time period, we rescued 11 Arctic Research Lab technician scientists from the ice pack.
Oh.
Up off the north coast. And that was a ski mission.
Oh, wow. Was that dangerous for you guys?
Well, yeah, it would have been. I didn't take that one. I had my choice of that one or one on the glacier, and I chose the glacier. But anyhow, they had been out to the T3 Island or one similar, and one of the ground crew pumped diesel into their fuel tank instead of avgas. And they got about a third of the way back to Barter Island, or to Barrow, excuse me. And one engine overheated and burned up. And they turned back and couldn't make it back to the ice island. So they landed on the floe ice.
Wow.
And they were all okay, except they needed to be rescued. And it was winter time and mostly 24-hour darkness. So they had an Air Force C-54 fly cover and kept them located and so forth, and they dispatched one of our 123s to land on the ice and pick them up. And I don't think you need to cut it off, but you may want to treat this a little, that way.
Yeah,
they were able to talk to this. It was a C-47 that they'd gone in on the pack ice. And like I said, the 11 people were all okay, and so they called him. Colonel Stringer was flying that mission, and asked how thick the ice was. And the people on the ground said, "How thick does it need to be?" And they said, "Yeah, we got that much." So, anyway, they landed and loaded his people on, and were able to very successfully get him back to Point Barrow.
So you chose not to do that. You were flying the glacier mission instead?
Right.
So can you tell us?
It was going to be a less number of days.
And that was why?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about the glacier mission? I don't think we've spoken to anyone who was actively involved with it.
Well, I think Maynard Miller was from Harvard, or at any rate, he's one of the few glaciologists in the country at the time, and I don't know whether they've done any expansion or not, but he was drilling and cataloging and keeping good track of all the experiments and research they were doing. They determined that the Taku field was one of the few remaining glaciers in the country, at least, that was growing a bit. And he had what do you call it when a student gets a summer's work and some credit and so forth?
Oh, like an intern?
Yeah. He had several interns. Well, we would, in his early days, he walked up from Juneau up onto the field, which was like a day and a half trip.
Wow.
And he was very very excited to have our support, because we could land on the glacier, take in people, take in supplies and so forth, and they would spend, I don't know, probably several weeks there doing all the good stuff that he needed done, and we were their support to take a lot less time and haul a lot more kinds of gear and equipment in.
I see.
And we landed at either two or three different elevations. It's about 3,000, 5,000, and 9,000. And it was a pretty good exercise at 9,000 feet because the snow was usually kind of soggy and gripped you a whole lot more.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to get a longer run to get airborne at 9,000 feet than you did at 3 or 5.
Wow. So that was something, it wasn't just a one-time, that was something
oh, no.
You guys did.
We probably supported him for 4, 5, 6 summers.
Wow. I was going to ask about the altitude, how high you could land the C-123s at. Was 9,000 about the limit?
It's about that's as far as we've tried it.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want to get stuck up there.
No.
So what do you think? Well, I guess this may be a sensitive question. In 1971, do you step down as commander or?
You
got a promotion, right?
Let me see if I can put it as gently as possible. I think that I would prefer to say I argued with the right general at the wrong time.
I see. That was very well done, though, how you phrased it. So were you unhappy that you were leaving? Would you like to stay longer?
Well, yeah. And as a matter of fact, in our civilian capacity, what he wanted me to do was to fire two or three of my guys, and I refused to do that. And then we embarked on about an 8-year legal battle, and we won it at the Ninth Circuit Court.
Wow.
Believe it or not.
That's big time serious.
It was.
I see. So then, and then you went to, did you go to Juneau at that time, or were you still?
No, the National Guard headquarters had moved to Anchorage from Juneau.
I see. And what were you doing there at that time?
After our departure.
Yeah.
I was at what they called an operations staff officer. I looked into the training and devised different training scenarios for crews and the units involved.
And was that all National Guard or all Air National Guard, or was that specifically with Coolis that you were?
Well, yeah, it was primarily Coolis, although I also then interacted with the active Air Force at Elmendorf for exercises and our participation.
And the National Guard headquarters, when you were there, was that at Fort Richardson?
No, it was downtown Anchorage.
Oh, okay. Like an office.
Yeah, before they built the new headquarters at Fort Rich.
I see.
Incidentally, that has become a joint base nowadays. I don't know if you're aware of that, the Army and the Air Force. And it's called Elmendorf Richardson, I believe.
Oh, really? We were up there, but we were just with the National Guard headquarters guys, so...
Just a sidelight.
That's good to know. So, what do you feel overall was the most important mission at Coolis? Or one of them, like, if you had to pick one thing that you're really proud of, something that you did?
Well, I think the prominence nowadays is the worldwide mission... with the 130s and tangentially and equal importance, of course, is the rescue.
Yeah.
So it'd be real tough to pick one and hang your hat on it totally. And I had the pleasure and whatever of writing the first proposal to get us 130s.
Oh, wow.
And that was shortly after I went full time. But they eventually got there. But the ensuing, you had to go through about 8 or 9 different commands with different generals and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And they all said okay until it got to the Strategic Air Command. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, we agree with that, except until all of the active units that are going to have them are equipped with 130s, I can't see the Guard having any. And the subsequent 3 or 4 generals all agreed with that. And so, at any rate, that's another aside.
Yeah. When did you guys finally get the C-130s?
Oh, I think they came aboard in about 74, the first one, somewhere in there.
I see. So you had left before?
Oh, yeah. I was downtown in the...
At the headquarters?
Yeah.
I see. Let me ask Marge, do you have any more questions or things you had? We talked about skis and stuff before you came in. Is there anything else you thought you wanted to ask?
I guess mostly I'm curious what you think the unique contribution of Kulis and the unit was as far as the Cold War.
Oh, I can just barely hear you, but I think you want to know what the my feeling of the main contribution to the Cold War.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I suppose having a unit with, you know, an integral unit, and incidentally, we were a squadron up until 69, and squadron is the smallest unit that can operate and support itself.
Mm-hmm.
And we were slightly expanded squadron, but to have that unit ready to come with its own assets and people and training to augment the active service when things got hot, that would have been the prime contribution.
So just to have a sort of a ready unit.
Absolutely.
Not to mention your location.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that, you know, they wouldn't have necessarily left us there or here, depending upon the overall worldwide needs.
Mm-hmm. If you'd been in Ohio, it would have been different.
Very likely.
Great. Well,
so we're getting the text of the document.
Okay.
And if you wanted to go through your comments... and then that way I can just grab those from you right now if you don't mind. Is it still all right?
Sure, sure.
Okay. That's getting printed now because I didn't have a copy with me. So once we get that, we'll be ready to grab it. Let me go get it from the printer. I'll be right back.
Okay.
What's the general feeling amongst the... Air Guard about the closure of the base?
Well, that was a little controversial among the members right out here at the 144th and 176th.
Mm-hmm.
And it does make some sense from my vantage point,
mm-hmm.
but it also does not have the requirement anymore, like it had in the Cold War, to rely on it as a survivable, usable piece of military real estate, let's say. As long as the guard unit and people and the hierarchy in the state headquarters can maintain a good working relationship with the active, you sort of have the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to have some headache getting to the facility that's being developed on Elmendorf in comparison to their arrival at Kulis, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a pretty minor glitch.
Okay. I have the document here if you're ready to go through it.
Okay.
And you can just let me know your
Again,
comments.
Some of these are going to be technical, but if you really are looking for accuracy, why? On page 4, you talk about the C-47 and 123, the door height needing to be widened.
Oh, okay.
The 47 didn't, C-47 did not need any change to the bigger hangar.
So there was no change for the C-47.
Right. The 123 needed it, like I described to you, for the tail only. It was wide enough for the wings, just barely, but it was wide enough.
I see. Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
And were they talking about Hangar 3 or the $1 million hangar for the wooden doors?
Well, I guess we kind of used the $1 million hangar was the larger hangar that was used once the transport mission.
Right.
Did that have wooden doors or no?
No, it did not.
Okay, so that never had wooden doors.
No. I was telling you about after the earthquake, we had to raise them by hand, and that's how I got acquainted with them.
I see. What kind of doors were they? They weren't were they the drop down?
Well, they had some of both. We had three on each side of the accordion one.
Okay.
That were metal, and we pushed those with a tug.
Okay.
And then the center one raised by, when it was working right, it raised by mechanically. Otherwise, we had to drag a chain physically.
And was it just during the earthquake that you guys had to do the chain, or was it also?
Oh yeah, it was there all the time, you know. But it was because it was damaged slightly by the quake.
Yeah. Was the mechanical, did it work pretty well so it would pull itself up, or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, these are good. These are not, they may be technical, but these are definitely what we need. Any kind of little mistakes, that's the kind of stuff we want to fix.
On page 8, line 6, the maintenance shop was on the east side, not behind the little hangar.
Okay, so the east side.
Yeah, that's where we had our mechanic for maintenance, sheet metal and support. And that beside the little hangar.
So when you had the little hangar, and then there's that space in between the little hangar and the bigger hangar, that part was the machine shop?
No, it was on the other side.
Oh, the other side of it.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
Of the little hangar. And there really wasn't much of a breezeway. It was, matter of fact, we opened one door from operations and walked right from 3 into the bigger one.
I see. So breezeway is probably a little too exaggerated. It was more just like butted up against each other.
That's right.
I see.
That all became one building, really.
Yeah. So there was the mechanical shop, and then there was the hangar itself, the little hangar, right?
Yep.
And then it was just connected to the big hangar.
And on the east side, there was the personnel shop and the commander's office, and then that was right out near the parking area.
I see.
Then the sheet metal maintenance portion of it.
So what did you guys use the little hangar for once you weren't using fighter planes anymore?
It became a personal equipment, parachute rigging area, as well as just a general meeting area when need be, or if you had a project. And then it finally became where the loadmasters would rig their loads, pack the parachutes, and whatnot for airdrops.
Yeah, it looks like that's what they're doing now with it. And they added the parachute tower.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so go ahead, keep going.
Okay, on page 9, mm-hmm. line 9, it says that they operated the F-86 until 58.
Mm-hmm.
And it might have been up close to the end of 57.
Okay.
But I didn't know whether you wanted to, because I joined in 58, and they were well into the transport mission by then.
So you think it's more up till 57?
Yeah.
Okay. That's good information. All right.
Okay. And on page 11, your delineation seems to indicate that the skis were a modification done for the Alaskan environment.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like I told you, SAC had them built and operated them new for a short period of time, and then we got them.
Okay.
And if you're going to do any modification correction there, then the last line talks about that we're the only unit in the Air Force, but the Griffiths Air Force Base in New York has finally come to my mind. But there was an Air Force unit that operated them, because they delivered half of them to us.
I see. So they weren't the first unit in the Air Force, because...
Right.
I see.
Or the only unit in the Air Force.
I see. It was the second, because it was the... Did you say which base? But it was the base in New York?
Right.
Okay. That's good. Thank you.
Okay, and page 12...
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about the in 69 when the
yeah, we've had some problems with that paragraph. I don't know. Go ahead though.
Well, we became the we were authorized a group status, group size unit, and it became the 176 because in the old days they didn't think we were ever going to get beyond a squadron. And they authorized the 144th Wing and Group to a unit in California.
I see.
This is just background kind of stuff.
No, that's really good information, because usually you see the 144th, when you know, at Air National Guards, they start small and then they become a group. But
right.
They,
yep.
That makes sense why you went to 176. I could never figure that out.
Okay. And then, of course, the Wing, what they did is they said, okay, if you're really going to grow... We'll designate a wing, and you'll keep that and grow into it if possible.
I see.
Okay. And then it, the last sentence says the 176 TAC Dispensary Communications Flight Civil Engineering, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Joined the TAG,
mm-hmm.
The TAC Airlift Group. But what happens is you have the... you go from a squadron to a group, and when you gain the group, or the group is authorized,
mm-hmm.
you have, and so you would have had, we had an aircraft maintenance squadron, an admin support squadron, and a logistics squadron. Otherwise, you can't operate on your own.
Yeah, you're not a group at that point. Yeah, if you don't have those guys. Okay, so it's, we make
generally
it sound...
Generally speaking, there are three or more groups to constitute a wing, three or more squadrons to constitute a group.
I see.
So forth. And so, see, we had all those functions as a squadron, and we didn't have separate flights except for the communications flight we had when we were still a squadron.
I see.
But we were not authorized a dispensary until we got the group structure.
I see. So it's not that they joined the group. It's because of all those units became the group.
Came with it. You're right.
So it's became. Okay, so we'll rework that sentence.
It became the 176th group, including...
The communications.
Yeah,
I see.
The support squadron, the logistics squadron, the aircraft maintenance squadron, the dispensary, the comm flight, and the civil engineering flight.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah, thank you. That's good.
Okay, I think that's... well, there's maybe one or two others here. I'm thumbing through.
Yeah, no, take your time. And if you find that you have more, you can just go ahead and send me an email if you want with them.
Okay.
We're waiting for other people to get stuff back, and I think we asked for them to, all the comments to come back by August 20th or so. Take your time if you find other stuff. Feel free to send it.
Okay. Page 19.
Okay.
you know, it's maybe I'm nitpicking, but at any rate, like I said, we occupied the airport at Fairbanks, and I unfortunately was the on-scene commander. But the runway really never got underwater.
Okay.
But the water came up between the taxiway and the runway, and the water was right outside the terminal building of the runway. So it was really surrounded by water, no question about it.
But not underwater.
But not underwater.
Okay,
no.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff did you do as the on-scene commander?
Well, the airlines were still operating there, believe it or not.
Wow.
And so I had to coordinate with them. And Alaska Airlines was very helpful. To begin with, when we had refugees, evacuees, whatever we should call them, we just made sure the count was okay, that we had enough seats and whatnot to accommodate them.
Mm-hmm.
And when we realized it was going to get that big, Alaska Airlines volunteered. We did a little bit of coercion, but to manifest them all.
I see.
And so then we had accurate count of who and names and so forth.
Yeah.
And contacts back in Fairbanks and so forth. And so that took some of my time as well. And then there were Army Guard units that were hauling people out of downtown Fairbanks in 30, 40-foot semis in a multi-fuel big 5-ton tractor.
Wow.
And some of those poor guys would be up to their waist in water driving through that between downtown Fairbanks and the airport itself.
Wow.
And so that was, you know, you had to make sure the guys were accounted for and going to get fed and
yeah. All
the little details.
Did you just sleep at the airport for however long you were there for?
I beg your pardon?
Did you just sleep at the airport for however long you were there for?
Was I there?
Yeah, were you just sleeping at the airport?
Oh, yeah, I think maybe 4 or 5 days.
Yeah? Wow.
It hit hard and then went down fairly quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there were about 3 other sites that had people. The college was one of them.
Mm.
The bigger buildings downtown. And so we had to, we didn't have much in the way of telephone or good radio communication, but we had to maintain contact. And so I had a couple helicopters at my disposal, and we'd do a shuttle around those, keeping track of what they had and what they needed.
And those weren't your helicopters, right? I mean, you guys didn't
have
that.
Beg your pardon?
You guys, Coolis didn't have helicopters tell the
rescue
guys, right?
Oh, no, these were contractors.
I see. Okay. Go ahead and keep going.
Okay. On page 21.
Okay.
Let's see. It says, the whole story is about the airplane that went through the ice.
Yeah.
We were not delivering supplies to Native Alaska Village. I don't know how much. You want me to give you the whole background on that?
That would actually be wonderful.
Okay. It occupies 9 pages in the Alaskan Air Command's history volumes. It was a well thought out, I believe, and unfortunately didn't come off too well project.
Mm-hmm.
A small group in Eagle River and elsewhere wanted to establish a white fish fishery in Nyakuk and the adjacent lake. And one of the reasons was that there was a possibility to establish a little fishing, freezing, etc.,
mm-hmm.
commercial operation. And the market for it is the Jewish community in New York, who have a warm spot for whitefish in the round.
Mm.
Okay. The gentleman going for the whole project happened to own Eagle River Cold Storage out here, and he wanted us to fly the missions down there. And I told him that we could not do that in competition with commercial activity, mm-hmm. helicopters, etc. And he prevailed upon then-Senator Greening to further prevail upon the Air Force, and they authorized two missions to get
wow.
it done. And one of them was to haul a little cat in there to, you know, do plowing of the off the lake and so forth. And the other one was to haul in a prefab building and some supplies that would go with the building and a generator and so forth. And I was on the second load. The first load turned back because of bad weather, and they left their little cat at Dillingham.
Mm.
And we hired a fixed-base operator, a local fly-in guy out of Dillingham, to go in and drill the ice and record the depth.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that. And part of the other agreement was he would mark out about a 4,000-foot runway with spruce boughs.
Mm.
And can you hear me? You're fading a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I'm okay.
Okay. So we flew in one middle of one day in February, and there's the nicely marked out strip with spruce boughs. What he had not told us was that he was coordinating with a local homesteader, and when he drilled the ice, it was in very close to shore, and they correctly surmised that we would not be able to maneuver that close to shore, and so he just moved the runway, moved his markings out into the lake about 2,000 or 3,000 feet.
Oh.
Did not tell us, and he did not drill the ice out there.
Yeah.
So we went in thinking that we had the 24 inches of ice like we're supposed to have, and did what's called a skis down pass.
Mm-hmm.
We flew, let the airplane contact the snow, or the skis contact the snow, and put some weight on it, and then just kept on flying, turned around, and watched for what they call overflow. If there's water coming into your ski tracks, then you've fractured the ice and there's water coming up, you better not land.
So do you guys do that do you do that anytime you land on snow or land on ice, or is it just to...
Well, if we don't know the depth or we don't know the conditions,
but
it's a good idea to do it anyway,
yeah.
Landing on a lake or a river.
Yeah.
If you're on an ice field, you know, a glacier, then it's not essential.
Yeah.
Anyhow, there was no water, so we circled back, landed, and we're in the process of doing what they call a 9270. You turn 90 degrees one way and 270 back the other way,
mm-hmm.
so you're heading back where you come from.
Mm-hmm.
And we were to park at the end of the marked runway, unload the gear, and take off, come back home. About halfway through that 270 turn, the left ski started through the ice first, and then we boosted all we could to pull ourselves out, but it wasn't enough.
Wow.
And then we abandoned the airplane and watched it sink into the ice.
Oh.
And since it was an Air Force mission, it became their requirement to recover it.
I see.
We would have gladly done it, except it would have taken almost all of our personnel and resources for who knows how long.
Yeah.
And the Air Force tried blasting a trail to the shore, and there was an Army demolition guy that was doing it for him. What he failed to remember was that when you blow ice up, it's not going to go away. It goes up and comes back down.
Yeah.
And it riddled the airplane.
Oh, geez.
At any rate, so then they abandoned that effort. Put some bridge pontoons under the wings and the tail,
mm-hmm.
so that it would not sink. And very wisely, they surrounded it with a log boom,
mm.
So that the ice would not, as it thaws and goes out in the spring, damage the airplane anymore. They put an outboard motor on it, putted it over toward the shore, winched it back up off of the lake, and dried it out, changed the engines, etc. And then almost a year to the day later, I flew it back out.
Wow.
And almost a year after that, after they'd repaired the nose and tail, so forth, from the ice damage, I test-opted it again.
Wow. So you were the one actually flying it this whole time.
That's right.
Wow, that's great. That's a much better story.
But, you know, the wisdom of the whole project still has validity because the white salmon are a heavy predator on red salmon. I mean, the white fish are a heavy predator on red salmon roe.
I see.
And so the fishery would have been enhanced. They would have employed maybe a half a dozen folks, you know, and then it would have satisfied a need for a product that's sought after in New York. So,
yeah,
you know, it was a pretty much win-win, except that things didn't work out that well.
So the fishery, did that never happen then?
That's right.
Yeah. So I guess my question about that, let me make sure I understand the logistics of it. How long did it float with the pontoons before it was able to drag it out? Was that all through the winter?
Well, we were in there in February, so probably by May it would have been floating.
Okay, and then at that point they would have dragged it over and done all that.
Right.
So that was actually the Air Force who was dealing with that.
The Air Force did the recovery. at that time, any mission or project that they got going had to have the word "cool" in the designated mission name, and so they designated that one "Cool Rope," and the colonel who headed up the recovery activity when they set up a little recovery base and monitored it all winter and so forth. His son came down to him one morning at breakfast, so he relayed the story to me and said, "Dad, I know what that rope stands for." And he says, "What is it?" He said, "That's a recovery of plane eventually."
That's pretty good.
Yeah. And they did recover it eventually.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a year later and then 2 years that you were flying it. Were you able to fly it around after that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was our hangar queen. It was involved in several different things, but that was the most involved one.
Yeah, what else did it, hangar queen? I guess that means it was in the hangar a lot?
Well, another time, a couple winters before, it was in the hangar a lot. A couple winters before, we were supporting an Army exercise up near Nome, and I happened to be flying that same airplane, and got airborne in pretty snotty weather up at Big Delta, and lost the low blower clutch on number one engine.
Mm-hmm.
And so we circled and landed, and it sat there. I tried to get the maintenance officer to let me fly it home in high blower, but he declined. And some heavy winds came up and wrenched the control lock out of its mooring, and it damaged the ailerons and the drop tanks. So it spent some more time in there.
Wow.
Yep.
Maybe it was you, though, if you were flying it both times. Have you thought about that?
I thought about that, you betcha. At any rate.
All right, so did you have more comments?
I don't think I could have affected the low blower clutch failure.
Yeah, that's probably not you. And I don't think really the in the ice thing was your fault either, it sounds like. So did you have more comments about it?
I told you about the rescue of the Arctic Research Lab folks, didn't I?
I think so. Is that? That's the one, the 11 guys?
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. On page 24...
Okay.
The military charter was heading to Vietnam.
Oh, okay, yeah.
The morgue was actually set up in the motor pool building because it had the ability to be... hose down and sanitized.
I see.
Easier than, so, you know, it's just a, I know you, that you're bending some effort to memorialize Hangar 3. So it doesn't bother me. I just wanted to let you know.
No, I mean, I guess we read in an article that that was set up in the hangar. So I think it's a newspaper.
I think we wanted to.
Yeah.
But the forensic guy said, no, we need to be able to lay them out here on, plus the fact that there are lots more people passing through Hangar 3 than were in the motor pool fire station building.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's definitely good. I think that the article that we have that says that was probably done, I think it was done that the next day, so it's good to know that. We'll change that for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. You were there at the time?
Oh, yeah.
I guess that's right, it was 70. How was that? Is that an accurate picture of what happened, the you guys fighting the fires?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I love to tell a story about one of our motor pool guys.
Yeah, definitely.
He was driving a big fire truck into the plane while it was burning.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody in a airport maintenance pickup was in his way, and so he told this guy in the pickup, get that thing out of the way, I want to get in there with my load of fire retardant and fight the fire. And the guy says, oh, I can't move, shut up, you know. So Leaf put the big old O-10 fire truck in gear and pushed that guy's pickup out of the way and went on in, and you know, they suppressed a lot of the jet fuel fire.
Mm-hmm.
And the next morning he came in and said, I think I'm in trouble. And I said, what happened? So he told me, and I said, you just go back to work. I love to answer a question like that if it comes.
Yeah.
And the guy never complained.
Yeah, why would you not move out of the way for someone who's going to fight a fire?
Yeah, well, it was, you know, a pretty narrow little road strip heading in there.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, it was easy to block, but by the same token. Anyway, I digress. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. So, did you guys work with the airport so that you could actually, you guys, did you have an agreement that you would help out with crashes that happened at the airport?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And for several years, we had superior fire crash equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And we did the same thing, I think they still do, for snow removal.
Oh, okay.
You know, there's a lot of runway out there nowadays, and
yeah.
If they can add a couple pieces of snow blowers and removal equipment and get the job done quicker, well, that's benefit to everybody.
Now, did you guys train for what to do in case of a crash, or?
Oh, yeah.
With the airport, or just with you guys?
Pardon me?
With the airport? Did you train with the airport, or was it just training with amongst the guardsmen?
Well, some of both, but we have more stringent. The guard had more stringent training requirements and frequency of it than the airport itself.
I see.
They may have changed it, but the time I was there, we had what I considered considerably superior trained firefight crews.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess that makes sense. You know, it's someone who's the whole... Yeah, that makes sense that you guys would have more stringent stuff. Were there any other crashes at the airport while you were there?
I think you've got them all.
Yeah. Okay. All right, keep going if you have more.
Nope, that's it.
That's all your comments?
Mm-hmm.
All right. How did it feel to you? Did it read okay? Did you think it was interesting?
Maybe my battery's going, but you're fading out. What now?
I'm sorry. I said, how did it feel to you? Did it feel, the text, did it feel interesting? Was it, you know?
Oh, I liked it, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think you've done a good job.
Well, and we're hoping there's going to be, the booklet's going to be, you know, shiny and glossy with photos, and I'm hoping that it'll look really good. I think we'll be happy.
Deal.
All right. Well, if you have more comments, the other thing is, can you tell me how we're going to put you in the acknowledgments and the some of the recordings here will go to the Alaska, what did I say it was before, the Oral
University?
Yeah, the Oral History Project. Is there a way you'd like your name to be? Do you want to be Lieutenant Colonel Harold Wolverton, retired, or do you have a preference?
No, that's fine.
Okay.
That's accurate.
All right. Then that's how we'll do it. Thank you so much for your time. If you have more comments about the text or you remember something and it comes up, you can go ahead and send me an email.
I sure will.
Yeah, and I really appreciate your time.
No problem. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you so much. Have a good rest of the day.
Okay, Catherine.
All
you
right.
Too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.